Therapy.
Hello there, I'm Jen Kerrison. Welcome back to Group Therapy as we kick off our third season. The way in which a marriage is conducted, its rules and ramifications has changed over time, but it remains culturally universal. Matrimony binds people emotionally and economically together for life. But what happens when one of you wants out? Should we live by the mantra of individualism, or do we honour our contract till death do us part? Today we're hearing from Sawa, a 28-year-old woman who has been married for about 5 years. But first, let's meet our guest. It's regular guest clinical psychologist, Dr. Alice Jones. Hello, Alice. Welcome to the show. How are you today? Welcome back.
Very well. Thank you. Happy New Year.
Thank you very much, and to you. We're also joined by sociologist and author of The New Rules, Catherine Hakim. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to the show.
Pleased to be with you.
Thank you very much for being here. Now, we were meant to be joined also by writer and academic Miriam Francois-Serra, but she's stuck in traffic. So we're going to kick off the show anyway, and let's hope that that the Sunday afternoon traffic clears and Miriam gets here at some point so she can give us her fine opinion. But what we'll do is we'll kick off with the dilemma now, and then we'll hope that Miriam gets here at some point throughout the show.
I'm stuck in a loveless marriage and I can't see a way out. At first, I thought this was it. It was arranged, but I trusted Mum and Dad. I liked him, I thought I loved him, but now I lie in bed lonely next to him. He says he loves me, but I don't feel it. I see him as nothing more than just a friend. I admit I've changed. I'm not the girl I was on my wedding day. It doesn't feel like a phase, but how do I know that? What if I change again in 2 years' time and I'm happy again and it's all been worth it? But what if I don't? I feel caught.
You're listening to London's Resonance FM. You're here with me, Jen Kerrison, and our guests, Alice Jones and Catherine Hakim. And unfortunately, no Miriam Serra, but she may be here before the end of the show. So, Alice, as a psychologist, tell me, what stands out for you in this dilemma?
Lots of dilemmas, I think, within this one. So what I'm sort of thinking about Sawa is that she's really reaching a stage of lots of conflict for herself, where she's feeling quite torn between following what she's interested in doing and thinking about who she is as a person, but also kind of staying true to the things that she's already invested in. So she's been married now for about 5 years, and this was a marriage that was kind of arranged for her by her parents. She's got quite a lot to think about when she thinks about kind of extracting herself from that kind of a thing.
So the core dilemma is that she actually has so much to think about. So many dilemmas rolled into the one. Okay, Catherine, you've done a considerable amount of research into relationships and loveless marriages. Is Sawa's situation common, do you think?
It is and it isn't. All marriages have both strong points, positive sides, and less positive sides. And I think what's happening with a lot of young people is that they have quite unrealistic expectations of relationships. They have this idea that the marital partner and the relationship should somehow be absolutely all-giving, that it should fulfil all of their wants and needs, that the person should be a friend but also a lover, that it should be exciting as well as providing security and continuity and friendship. And they just have expectations that are way beyond what a single relationship can provide. I think older people have greater recognition that your marriage provides certain things, it can't provide everything, and therefore that's why you have friends, that's partly why people enjoy their jobs, their work colleagues, they have hobbies, they have interests beyond the marriage, and they don't expect the marriage to fulfill absolutely all of their needs. And she's demanding that this relationship not just provide her with what is apparently a happy home and friendship and a loving relationship, but she wants excitement as well.
Okay, well, we're definitely going to get into this idea of expectations of marriage throughout the show. I guess, Alice, I'm curious to hear from you this idea that the media and perhaps Hollywood or even Bollywood give us this idea that this love is passionate fireworks display, but and perhaps, you know, this backs off what you've said, Catherine, about our expectations. But I guess for me, this may sound cynical, but most of us have this at best for the first 3 months of a relationship. But Hollywood would make us think that people who settle for something other than fireworks are timid or weak, or they should be pitied. What do you think about this idea of how the media builds our expectations?
Sure. So I think we all hold those expectations, and we remember what it's like when we get into a new relationship for the first time. It's exciting, and we're kind of excited about seeing the person, and we feel nervous about it, and all those kinds of things happen. And then we reach a stage where it's not quite so exciting because we kind of know what we're getting a little bit. Things become a little bit more predictable.
The novelty wears off.
Right. But in that, things also change, I think, for the better. Things become, you know, you feel more content, you feel more secure. I don't think any of those things can ever be kind of, you know, underestimated in terms of how important they are for your overall functioning. If you spent your whole time in some sort of adrenaline frenzy, you really wouldn't be very functional as a human being. So what we need, and quite a lot of kind of research has thought about, you know, attachment and the use and the kind of the need that we have for kind of secure attachment in our romantic relationships as well as our other relationships being really good for our mental health overall.
Catherine, do you have thoughts on this idea of the first 3 months and perhaps how the media pushes us to have this expectation?
I'm not sure that it is just the media. It's the whole of modern society, and the culture of modern society pushes people in the direction of thinking that there should be these sorts of fireworks when you first meet someone, love at first sight and all of that nonsense. But the key point is that people don't differentiate between what's important in a long-term relationship and what's important in a short-term relationship. And so their concept of what is a good relationship is often just the short-term relationship, something that's going to fizzle out in 3, 4, 5 months, rather than what's required for a long-term relationship. If you look at the research, the evidence is that the kind of sexual fireworks that people have in the beginning of a relationship generally doesn't last beyond the first 2-3 years of marriage. It's after the first 3 years of marriage that you find that that tends to calm down a great deal, and that's the point at which people start to think in terms of maybe the grass is greener on the other side of the fence, maybe they start thinking about an affair.
Well, after that comes the 7-year itch, doesn't it? So, Alice, what then makes... what makes for a good long-term relationship? Once we get past the fun and excitement and the sexual fireworks of the first couple of months, or couple of years, I would say, if you're lucky, but that's good research, Catherine. What next?
Okay, so you're asking someone who's been married for a whole of 6 months.
Sorry, perhaps
so
we shouldn't have had you on today's
think
show.
About my own advice. What am I going to tell myself to do in 6 years' time? I think it's important to be realistic about what you've got, what you're getting yourself into when you get married, and think about what the long term is going to be about. You are hopefully, you know, marrying somebody who's going to be a friend to you in the long term, who, you know, somebody who you can think about as somebody who you can trust, somebody you can confide in, somebody who will kind of weather stuff with you. Things aren't always going to be rosy. Some really rubbish things happen in lives, and you kind of need someone who's going to remain on your side and be able to talk stuff through with you. I think that's one of the most important things, is to be able to communicate with your partner so that when either of you are feeling unhappy, kind of need to work it through together if you're kind of dedicated to keeping a marriage going and being happy, the pair of you both being happy.
We will come to the, this idea of partnerships a little bit more later in the show, but I want to talk about marriage as a contract. Marriage as a piece of paper. I think all of us would agree that once someone gets married, it puts them into a different social sphere. You know, we've all seen as our brothers and sisters or our cousins and friends get married, and they start to get treated differently by the rest of the world, and we start to project a different sense of identity onto the world once you take on that separate social standing. I'm wondering, how do we reconcile the tension between our social identity and our innermost desires? And I guess where this question comes from is that Sawa is considering whether to or not to be in or out of this marriage. There's a great deal of inner turmoil that's going on for her by the sounds of things, but there's also this external pressure on the fact that she would go from being a married woman to no longer being a married woman. How do we reconcile this tension, Alice?
I think this is a really tough thing to try and work your head around. quite often when relationships fail, and particularly when marriages fail, it's quite easy to feel like you failed at some level, and no one wants to go around feeling like they're a failure. So that's something, I guess, that Sawa is currently wrestling with, the idea that she hasn't managed to keep her relationship going, and she seems to be putting a lot of the onus on herself about this. She's saying, I've changed in the past few years. What if I change again? What if I'm making a mistake? Not really perhaps considering what the role her husband is playing or not playing in, you know, I'm sure he's changed as well in the past few years. So I wonder if it's worth thinking a little bit more about the relationship and how that might have changed, rather than her really kind of sticking all the sort of feelings of blame and worry upon herself.
But this idea of moving from being within one social role into another, from a sociological perspective, Catherine, what sort of an impact does this make on us?
Well, an awful lot of people find the status of being a married person, whether it's a married man or a married woman, a very attractive thing. It's part of growing up. It's part of being an adult. It's part of moving out of childhood, being independent of your parents. And that is a major step forward that a lot of people welcome. And it's also possible that people do get married without having really thought it through, as she seems not to have, and understood that actually it isn't going to be absolutely perfect utopia every single year of your life. It's still something you have to work at, and which will something that will change over the years. I mean, it won't be the same 5 years in as or 10 years in as it was right at the very beginning. And I think she's just simply not getting to grips with the fact that you change and adapt. He will change and adapt. And thinking that there's an easy way out, that divorce is somehow the solution, is actually just ducking the problem of how she deals with her relationships, what she expects from marriage, rather than just assuming that, oh, I'll try again, start again, and it will somehow work out the next time. That's a very irresponsible approach to it.
Now, I suppose most people who enter into marriage enter into it thinking that it is for the long haul, and yet divorce rates, are they rising? Catherine, are divorce rates actually going up, or have they been in a constant state for some time?
They tend to rise at particular periods. They tend to rise when you've got a recession, because for a lot of women, the most important thing in the marriage is that the husband should be a breadwinner. And if husbands lose their jobs, if she loses her job, financial difficulties in a couple always leads to more rows and arguments and stress, and very often leads eventually to divorce. So overall, divorce levels are stable, although there's an awful lot of fuss about them being too high. But the interesting thing is that in some countries, they're low in Europe. In America and in Britain, we have very high divorce rates. In America, something like half of all marriages end in divorce. In Britain, it's between a third and a half, depending how you measure it. But in those two cultures, what we call infidelity or adultery or affairs are considered absolutely ruled out and impossible, unacceptable. And therefore, you have higher divorce rates and serial monogamy as people try to marry again. Whereas in continental European countries, you have very low divorce rates, partly because people do accept that affairs and friendships outside the relationship are an acceptable way to deal with problems.
Great. I would love to talk a little bit more about infidelity, but I want to come back to something that you mentioned at the top of the show around younger people's expectations for marriage. You said that perhaps as we get older, we have a little bit more of a sound understanding of what may come from this sort of contractual agreement of marriage. People are getting married older now than ever before, certainly in Britain and in the West. Why is it then, if people are getting older, based off what you said around perhaps these unrealistic expectations as younger people, if we're getting married older, why is the divorce rate still so high? Why don't we have this idea of what it's actually going to be like if we're a little bit more mature as we're getting married? Catherine?
Well, Britain and America, it's simply acceptable to get divorced, and therefore people think of that as a solution. In countries where it's less acceptable to get divorced, people don't reach for that solution as easily as that, and therefore there's a lower divorce rate. Getting married early or later really has very nothing to do with it.
But you said it does have something to do with our expectations.
Yes, but when we're talking about getting married older, we're still talking about people getting married in their 30s rather than people getting married in their 40s or 50s. And very often they have had what I would call a delayed adolescence in that, for example, they've been students throughout their 20s or they've been living at home. High proportion of young people are living at home nowadays.
So what you're saying is that people in their 30s are still young, Catherine. I'm very grateful for that. Thank you very much. And I can see Alice with two thumbs up in the air over there. Wonderful. Alice, this idea of divorce perhaps being a lot easier now, and as Catherine was saying, in the States, it's, you know, people get a divorce as just the option to it's the next thing that happens after marriage. Mm-hmm. I guess some would assume now that there's no stigma attached to divorce, but you mentioned these ideas of failure and shame at the failure of a marriage. Shame must be a powerful barrier to change. Is that right?
I think it is, absolutely, yes. The worry that, you know, you are going to be different to your friends who've managed to stay in happy marriages. You know, what have you done wrong compared to other people? Why have you failed? And I think lots of people think like this. But I'm kind of also interested in the flip side of staying, you know, not getting a divorce, is what are the costs of staying in an unhappy marriage? And there are a couple of ways to think about this. I don't think that, you know, you necessarily have to, if you don't get divorced, that your marriage necessarily has to remain unhappy. I think there are lots of things you can do to work towards making it happier. But I think it's important to consider what the costs might be of not, you know, taking quite a huge step of getting divorced. It's not easy to leave, you know, to extricate yourself from a relationship, from a house, from, you know, the place that you live, from your joint friends and all that kind of thing. So I think it's a huge step to take.
This idea of individualism, this idea that society now tells us that we must be happy at all costs. If you don't like your marriage, leave it. If you don't like your career, you can change it. No longer are we sort of working in the same industry for 30 years just because that's what we did. Even down to, you know, if you're not feeling well, take drugs to start to feel better. There's this sort of drive for being happy at all costs. What do you think that we've lost as individuals or as a society in this drive to gain absolute happiness? Catherine?
I don't think we've lost anything. People have always wanted to be happy in their lives, private lives, and in their work lives, public lives. One of the things that I say in my book, the New Rules, which is that some of the people who are having affairs are not people who are saying that they're desperately unhappy in their married life. Their marriages are actually very good marriages, and that's why they're successful at having affairs. What is missing is very often just one particular single thing, which they don't see any reason why their marriage has to provide everything for them, and so they look to affairs to provide that one thing that's missing. But they're being much more realistic as to what you can have from a relationship, or how much happiness you can expect in any particular context, and that you are yourself responsible for doing something to find a way out rather than placing the blame on other people and thinking that everything must change to make you happy.
Alice Jones, this idea of individualism, being happy at all costs, as a psychologist, what's your take on that?
I think the idea that we can be happy all of the time is a nonsense idea. That's We can feel happy, we should feel content with our world, we should feel pretty satisfied with what we've got, and we can and should work towards making things as, you know, comfortable and pleasant for ourselves as possible. But the idea that things should just be brilliant and the best thing ever is really nonsense, and it's something that really disappoints people frequently when everything isn't wonderful.
Would you agree, though, that there is a drive, Alice, for us to be happy all of the time? You know, you open up any of the weekend magazines and there's always an article about how you can make your life happier right now.
Yep, absolutely. Will this change your life? Will that change your life? Buy this thing, do this thing. And it does make lots of people feel like they're missing out. Lots of people feel very disappointed that they're not doing all these brilliant, exciting things that they could and should apparently be doing.
Well, let's flip that on its head then and look at living, as opposed to with a drive for constant happiness, living with this idea that we're fulfilling our duty, which I guess is the complete polar opposite to that. By contrast, is that a good thing to do if say, for example, Sawa feels that it is her duty because she has signed a contract, a marriage contract, it's her duty to remain married. Surely this can't be a good thing either?
Perhaps it depends on the values she's placing on that. If that's really the most important thing to her at this point, then yeah, it's something that she kind of needs to get her head around. I'm not sure that it is the most important thing in her life, which is why she's questioning it.
Mm-hmm.
But if it is one of those things that, you know, really kind of defines her as a human being, it's where her identity's at, then I think it is something that she's going to have to really think about carefully.
I can't remember which year it was, but the Queen said in the Queen's speech a couple of years ago that, of all the people she's met, and the Queen has met a lot of people, of all the people that she's met, the ones that are the happiest are the ones that have spent their life in duty to others. Your thoughts on this, Catherine?
That is one way that people obtain satisfaction, feeling that they are very good people and have done good. But a lot of people, for most people, private life is really very, very important part of their life satisfaction. And the interesting thing is that, on average, people who are married are always score higher on average satisfaction with life and happiness than people who are not. So in the long term, that is actually the route to happiness and success, if you like.
Being married, perhaps, whether that's a happy marriage or a dutiful marriage, then either way we're scoring higher on satisfaction scores. Catherine, I want to talk about your book, The New Rules, in that you look at, could you explain to me, is it infidelity is a means of keeping a happy marriage?
What I did was look at the people who are using internet dating. There are new websites that have been set up for people who are married. And therefore, the people who have affairs through these websites are married on both sides, both the woman and the man. And I was interested in why these websites had developed and who were using them. And what I found was that all of these people who are successfully using the websites to meet people were happily married people, except that most of them found that there was one or two particular things in their marriage which were not so satisfactory. Most typically, it was the fact that it was a celibate marriage and there was absolutely no sex life whatsoever at all. Not surprising in marriages of very long duration. They'd become friends rather than lovers.
Don't listen to this, Alice.
So they found a solution elsewhere with someone who was in a similar situation through these websites. But the interesting thing was that the people who regarded themselves as unhappy in their marriages were the least successful. Nobody wanted to know them. They were misery people. They were sour. They were, exuding negativity, and they were very unsuccessful in the dating websites. The people who were successful were the ones who are happy with their marriages, were absolutely committed to staying married and didn't want to change their situation at all, but they wanted a little bit of fun on the side, a bit of me time. And they were the attractive ones.
I struggle with this idea that we sign a contract before, it's a legal contract, and if you're a Christian, you sign this contract before the Lord, that you're going to love and obey, cherish and do all these things until death do us part, and yet then go out and seek fulfillment in other areas. I wonder, what's the point of doing this at all,
Alice? But you've got to remember that an awful lot of people do not have a religious marriage. An awful lot of people in a secular society go and have registry office marriages where there are no rules. There are no laws, no commitments, no idea, Catherine, of why people get married. People can make their own rules, and that's one of the reasons people do use registry office marriages.
Yes, they're making their own rules.
But even
Catherine, I don't disagree with you on the fact that people can make their own rules. But I would argue that most people that are going into a registry office have not said to one another, do you know what? Let's make a rule. In 10 years' time, when we're no longer doing it, I'm going to go log online and find myself another partner to have sex with. I don't think that people are out there making their own rules around that sort of thing.
I don't think that when people get married, they assume that sex will become a complete no-no for the rest of their life.
Haven't
within
they watched
the marriage.
Any sitcoms?
Now, there are a lot of marriages that end up being celibate marriages. You could say that that is breaking a fundamental assumption as to what marriage is about. If a husband came home from work one day and said, I've decided I'm not contributing to the finances anymore, I've got tired of doing that, I'm giving it up, and you're on your own, that would be considered a serious breach of the understanding of what marriage is about. But a lot of wives think it's perfectly okay to say, I'm cutting sex out from now on.
What, Alice Jones, this idea of keeping secrets, what are the psychological effects of keeping secrets within a marriage? If, and I'm going to assume these people haven't said in 10 years' time we're allowed to have sex outside the marriage.
So this was something I was curious about. So, Catherine, did you do any sort of work thinking about what the partners of these people, did they know that their other halves were off having affairs?
There's a difference between open marriages and people having discrete affairs. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about open marriages. That's a completely different research topic. And to my knowledge, open marriages are actually a fairly rare event for the very good reason that they don't work most of the time. And
are clandestine.
They're discrete affairs.
Discrete affairs. So this idea of keeping secrets,
Alice Jones,
what are your thoughts on the impact that that could have within a marriage, that someone's keeping a secret?
So I think the partner who is not having an affair, providing they're not having an affair themselves and everyone's just living in awful chaos,
being absolutely discreet.
Right. I think the impact for them and the impact for other family members is potentially quite huge. You know, feeling like you're living a bit of a lie, or that you other people are living a lie within your relationship, I think can be really, really, really damaging. I'm also interested in whether the people having an affair, what they've done to address the difficulties in their marriage, whether it's sex or intimacy or, you know, whatever else it is that they might be feeling, whether they're not just taking a quick route out as well. So they're just taking a, you know, it's quite easy to go and get sex, isn't it? But it's much more difficult to work on.
Speak for yourself, Alice Jones. Now, that is just about all we have time for in today's show. Thank you very much to both of my guests, Alice Jones and Catherine Hakim, whose book The New Rules is available in all good bookstores. Miriam Sarah, unfortunately, is still stuck in traffic, but if you jump onto the website tonight, she will be blogging for us, so you'll be able to get her perspective on today's dilemma. Tune in next week as we discuss the pregnancy and loss. I'll be joined in the studio by Cherry Healy. Group Therapy has been produced by the lovely Sophie Lording. Thanks so much for tuning in. Bye-bye.